Okay, so our course this term is quantum field theory for cosmology. And let me talk a little bit about the logistics of it. So prerequisites are these, these two courses there, but I'm happy to override that. If you feel ready for the course, then the, you know, if you need an override, let me know. Then we will have, so far it looks like we will have all of our lectures in this room. Initially, I was told that there would be exceptions, but apparently we can have it for the entire term in the Alice room. Then the reading week is from February 17 to February 25. Tutorials, discussions, office hours. I suggest we do this right after class. Every Tuesday after Thursday and Thursday, but also if somebody just wants to have a sort of one-on-one discussion where not everybody listens into it, let me know and we fix some other time and we meet in my lab or somewhere. Regarding the grades, at the moment I'm thinking we'll just do a project and a presentation. The project is likely going to be the simulation of the calculation and simulation of quantum fluctuations of fields, both in Minkowski space and then on expanding space times. The significance is twofold. One is it's really beautiful to see how quantum fields behave in practice by simulating their quantum fluctuations. But it's also kind of important because that's probably the origin of us. According to the current standard model of cosmology, the inhomogeneous distribution of matter in the universe goes back to quantum fluctuations. Exactly the kind of thing that we will calculate. That's the main aim of this course, to study how quantum fluctuations in fields arise and how we calculate them in Minkowski space and then also in the case of Hawking radiation and in the case of cosmology. And then eventually the standard model of cosmology, which describes the origin of structure of the inhomogeneities in the universe as coming from quantum fluctuations. It's really impressive that the statistics of quantum fluctuations matches the statistics of what we see in the sky. So that's the content. Then, as I said, the grades are going to be based on this project, but also then on a presentation about the project. You know, maybe 10, 15 minutes, something like that. Not a big deal. I will keep all relevant information up to date on this homepage of the course. So even if, I mean, you don't have to rely on email. You can also find it there, even though the email will be faster, of course. Then if you have symptoms of COVID or something like that, or just the weather is too bad or whatever, you can also either zoom in real time, or if you missed that, you can also see the video recordings of when I last taught it just 2 years ago. And here's the list at the bottom of this homepage is the list of the lecture notes and also video recordings. Right. Okay, any questions about these logistic issues? Yes?
Will we have those weekly recaps of the lectures, or?
I haven't quite decided on that yet. Actually, those of you who took my course GR last term, do you think it was too much of a burden, or?
I liked it. No.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Okay, so in that case, let's continue to do that. I was like 50-50. I wanted to ask you about this. So yeah, let's do that then. And I will send an email about that. And I will set up a crowd mark. So that means that the expectation is that once a week, you upload to CrowdMark a page of just summary of the two lectures of that week. Just the main points. You know, what was it all about? What was it all about? I find it very useful to, I mean, that's how I operated when I was a student. Even if I wasn't required to do it, I did it anyway, just to refresh the memory. A apparently that's how we get information from the short term to the midterm to the long term memory, by doing that. Yes, and the idea would be that this is not going to be exactly graded, but you basically ought to do like 80% of this, but without a grade. You just have to do it, right? And then the grade itself is going to be just based on the project and the presentation. Anything else about logistics? Okay, good. Then let's start with lecture one. Now, can you read this, or is this too small? Those of you who are in the last...
A little too small for me.
A little too small. Evan, could you... The thing is, you see, there's an advantage in having all of it there. It's because you see so much more then. See, it's just way more information. And especially what we just discussed is then still visible. I think that's best, because otherwise I had, when I previously taught and showed only one page at a time, I felt that I was continually referring back to what I just mentioned, and that can be repetitive. All right, then, let's start. So this course is a course on quantum field theory. Now, where the heck does this come from? What's the difference between quantum mechanics, quantum theory, and quantum field theory? Does anybody want to hazard a guess? What are the three? What's the difference between quantum mechanics, quantum theory, and quantum field theory? Yeah?
From my understanding, quantum theory is like the framework of getting a quantum mechanical description of theory. And quantum mechanics is where maybe one system is quantized, and but the field, field or any kind of field,
right.
Is classical or semi-classical.
Uh-huh.
And quantum field theory, everything is quantized.
That's right. That's exactly it. So quantum theory is the term for the framework. You know, you can apply quantum theory to whatever. If you apply it to a simple system such as one electron or one atom or something like this, then it's quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics typically non-relativistic simple systems. But if you apply the quantum theory framework to quantum fields and all of the quantum fields, then that's quantum field theory. So quantum mechanics and quantum field theory are just applications of the quantum theoretical general framework. So what's the historical background for this? Well, let's do a crash reminder on the history of all of this. So in around the year 1900, it had become clear that classical mechanics is untenable. There was the issue of black body radiation. You know that every object radiates heat all the time. Every object radiates electromagnetic radiation all the time. That's just because every object consists of charged atoms. I mean, not charged atoms, charged particles, like nuclei and electrons. They jiggle around, and as a consequence, electromagnetic radiation is being emitted. And the spectrum of that electromagnetic radiation depends on the temperature. And the spectrum looks like this. If you draw here the frequency of the radiation, and here you draw the amplitude or the intensity of the radiation as a function of the frequency, you get a curve that looks like this. It goes exponentially down here, but polynomially up on this side. And that had been measured by the year of 1900. But the theory, the classical theory, predicted not this. The classical theory predicted this. It would go on like this, right? It was the so-called ultraviolet divergency. Ultraviolet because high frequency is ultraviolet and beyond. And the prediction was clearly this. It would just diverge, which is not only not consistent with experiment, it's not consistent with anything, because it would mean that everything has an infinite heat capacity, an infinite capability to absorb and to radiate heat. And of course it's not infinite, right? So something had to give. And Max Planck was was a student in the late 1800s, and he went to his supervisor and he said, I want to work on physics, want to do a PhD. And the supervisor surely said, well, physics is done. There's just some little stuff that still needs clearing up. And he mentioned this problem, and he said, Planck, fix this. And Planck came up, and he just applied classical statistical mechanics to electromagnetism, as it was known, and he reproduced that same curve. But only when he then eventually, in desperation, made the assumption that the harmonic oscillations of electromagnetic waves could only have discrete energy levels, then suddenly this became the curve and was exactly matching experiment. But that was the beginning of quantum theory. You know, quanta are the discrete steps, discrete quanta of steps in the harmonic oscillators of the harmonic sine and cosine waves of electromagnetic waves. So that was the first hint that something involving that quantization, that discretization, was going to be important. And the discretization spacing was governed by Planck's constant H, right? So that was clear, but it was not clear what would replace classical mechanics. In 1900, it wasn't clear. There was also the photoelectric effect that Einstein got the Nobel Prize for. Photoelectric effect, just to remind you, is the phenomenon that light can ionize metals. And normally one would expect that this ionization behaves like a tsunami hitting a shore. The higher the waves, the more the devastation. That's not how it is with light on metals at all. Because if you take, for example, red light and shine it on a piece of metal, it's not going to ionize it, no matter how bright you make that red light. So you can hit the metal with a tsunami of red light. It's not going to ionize at all, right? But if you take a weak light source, but it's like blue or ultraviolet, then suddenly it can ionize. And that could not be explained with the wave picture. You need the particle picture. Einstein came along and showed, if you assume that light is actually carried by little energy packets, photons, then you can explain that. So clearly, electromagnetism couldn't be just a tsunami picture, just the waves. It also had particle properties. And then the stability of matter. In 1900, they had understood that atoms are mostly empty. There were these experiments of Rutherford and others that showed that there are tiny little protons in the middle and then electron clouds around it. So little planetary systems. But if this chalk was made out of little planetary systems, could it be stable? Imagine a bunch of little planetary systems. They would, of course, just chaotically just crash into each other, right? The stability of matter had to be explained. And the stability of matter goes back to the uncertainty principle. We will later see. Well, maybe I should just tell you right away. So in case you don't know, if you take an individual atom, like a hydrogen atom, then you can ask, well, okay, if this is a planetary system, how can this possibly be stable, right? And indeed, if you take a proton here, an electron there, and literally you could do that, and you can experimentally do this, take a proton here, an electron there, and you give the electron a little bit of momentum, then it will actually orbit around the proton, and being an accelerated charge, it will radiate. It's just like an antenna, right? An accelerated charge. It will radiate. So it will radiate off energy, and therefore it will have to lose potential energy. And so it will get closer to the proton. And as it gets closer, it will oscillate around the proton more furiously, and so it will radiate more furiously. And so it will even faster spiral in towards the proton, and eventually it ought to crash into the proton, but it doesn't. Right? It doesn't. It settles in the S wave configuration, the lowest energy state. And that's guaranteed by quantum mechanics. Of course, you could solve the Schrödinger equation to find out that that's the case. But if you just know the uncertainty principle, you can also predict that this is what's going to happen. Because if the electron was to in spiral closer and closer to the proton, the delta x, the uncertainty in position, would become very small eventually, right? Smaller and smaller. The proton is only 10 to the minus 15 meters large. So the delta x would become really, really small before it even hits the proton. But But that means because of the uncertainty principle, delta P would have to be very large. But the large delta P, large momentum uncertainty, must mean a large energy, large kinetic energy, enough for it to escape again. And so there's a balance. And that means that the uncertainty principle is actually preventing the atom from crashing into itself, from the electron and the proton just to mash together. So these were just some of the indications that classical mechanics was just at its end, right? It could not explain the black body radiation. It could not explain the photoelectric effect. It could not explain the stability of matter. So something had to give, something had to be invented or discovered, and that was in 1925. So next year it's going to be 100 years, when Heisenberg discovered, was the first to discover non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And in essence, what he discovered is that we can keep the equations of motion, not just the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator. No, all equations of motion are the same in quantum mechanics as they are in classical mechanics. But you have to make the canonically conjugate pairs of variables non-commutative. And of course, that opens a whole Pandora's box of other issues, because once they are non-commutative, they can no longer be number valued, so they have to be operator valued, and then they have to be represented on a Hilbert space, and all of that stuff follows then. But the basic principle is simply that you keep the equations of motion and you have to introduce a non-commutativity. Now, that was in early 1925. And then, a few months later, Schrödinger came along and said, I have another way of doing all of this. And you see, while Heisenberg found the origin of the discretization that had been observed by Planck earlier, and also by Heisenberg, also by Einstein in his photoelectric effect, it's a discretization because individual photons do the ionization. The discretization that was new to nature was, in Heisenberg's way of looking at it, induced by the fact that these canonically conjugate variables, x and p, could no longer be number valued. They had to be matrix valued. And matrices can have discrete eigenvalues. And so you get a discretization because of the discreteness of eigenvalues, for example, of the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom, Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator. And then Schrödinger came along with a Schrödinger equation. He had another explanation for where discretization comes from. Schrödinger had the clever idea that he remembered that even in classical physics, there is an instance where discretization comes up naturally. And what he had in mind was a string attached to a wall. If you take a string, attach it to a wall, it could even be that cable there if it was a bit more conveniently located, a string attached to the wall, and then you can create standing waves by whipping the string, right? And you can arrange it, if you choose the frequency of whipping just right, you can arrange it that you have one big wave, I mean, actually half a wave, right? So you have one, you have half a wave, or you can have a complete wave, or you can three half waves, and so on, depending on the frequency. But you cannot choose a frequency such that you get like 7/3 of a wave. It's not going to be a standing wave, right? So you get a discrete set of frequencies at which you get nice standing waves. And so he thought, well, maybe that's why we have discretization in the hydrogen atom too, where the electron is like a string, but it's sort of electromagnetically bound to the proton, the same way that the laptop might be with a cable bound to the wall. And so as the electron goes up and down, so to speak, around the proton, you have these standing waves. So he was looking for a wave equation, and that was the Schrödinger equation. His reasoning was really wild and didn't stand the test of time. He took some equations from classical mechanics, the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and then did some crazy stuff to it that made an eye appear and then said, oh, that's my equation. So that was not a good way to derive anything. It's not something, it didn't prove to be fruitful. But the end result was, of course, fine. That's the Schrödinger equation. At the time, Schrödinger didn't know that this is the same as the Heisenberg stuff. You know, it's just a few months apart. But Schrödinger's equation was very popular from the beginning because it's much easier to deal with this than with having to work out Hilbert space representations of non-commuting objects first. And then a few months later, I think that was already in 1926, Dirac then showed the equivalence of the two and showed that the two ways of doing quantum mechanics are related by choosing the position basis in the Schrödinger case, choosing the energy basis in the case of Heisenberg. He had worked in the energy eigenbasis and not in the position basis. And also choosing the Heisenberg picture of time evolution, Heisenberg's case, and the Schrödinger picture of time evolution in Schrödinger's case. So it wasn't obvious, really, that those two are the same framework. But in hindsight, of course, we know it's just a choice of bases in the Hilbert space and a choice of picture for the time evolution that that makes up the difference in appearance between the two ways of quantum mechanics. Okay, so this was all very successful and useful. And it necessitated, now from Dirac's picture, from Dirac's point of view, it was clear what had been necessary in order to go from the classical theory to the quantum theory. Namely, as we discussed before, the equations of motion can be kept, but we must have non-commutativity. Sure, in Schrödinger equation, in the case of Schrödinger's equation, this is a little bit buried because we already work with a representation. This is really p squared. But if you write it as minus h bar squared Laplacian, then it doesn't look like p squared anymore. So it is more instructive to look at it in the Heisenberg picture. And then we see that what's really going on is that the equations of motion stay the same, but we change the commutation relations. We make things non-commutative. So the commutator between x and p is then ih bar, which implies that x and p cannot be number valued. But I want to stress that just by knowing these two things, namely that the equations of motion stay the same and the commutators become these, well, and the third thing, which is that you need to know that the realness of the position and the momentum and other observable variables, the realness translates into hermeticity, so that x dagger is x, p dagger is p, so that they're self-adjoint or at least symmetric operators. Once you know that, the rest follows. The rest is just working out the math. There's no more creativity needed for this. So once you know the equations of motion stay the same, the commutation relations become those, and x dagger is x and p dagger is p, then all the predictions follow. It's just math then to work it out. There's no more physics needed. Now, an immediate question that people were asking at the time is this. They said, OK, x and p can no longer be number valued. All right, but what can they be instead? And as Heisenberg had shown, they can be matrices. In fact, he called his quantum mechanics not quantum mechanics. He called it matrix mechanics because he represented the x and the p as matrices in the energy basis, right? If you have the hydrogen atom, then you have a discrete set of eigenvectors, and in this eigenbasis of the hydrogen atom, the x and the p are discrete matrices. But as Heisenberg had shown, the x and the p's were infinite by infinite matrices. And so the question arose, well, okay, we cannot represent them as number valued functions anymore, but does it have to be as bad as infinite by infinite dimensional matrices that we have to represent them with? It turns out, yes. You see, let's assume that x, the position observable and the momentum observable, can be represented as finite dimensional matrices. In principle, finite dimensional matrices can be non-commutative, right? So one might think that's possible, but it's not. There are no finite dimensional representations of the XP commutation relations. And the reason is easy to see. Consider this in this equality here and take the trace on both sides. On the left hand, we have then the trace of a commutator. But remember that a commutator has a cyclic invariance for, you know, the that the trace has a cyclic invariance. The trace of AB is the trace of BA. So this means that the trace of a commutator is always zero. But on the right-hand side, we then have the trace of IH bar times the identity. But what's the trace of the identity matrix? Well, that's the dimension of the Hilbert space. So on the right-hand side, we have IH bar times the dimension of the Hilbert space. And on the left-hand side, we have zero. So what we have is that the trace of the left-hand side is the trace of the right-hand side. So zero is equal to IH bar times n, n being the dimension of the Hilbert space representation. And you see, even if we make n the dimension very, very large, this doesn't get better. It gets worse, right? So what that means is that there cannot be finite dimensional representations of the X and the P. We have to work with infinite dimensional representations. Namely, the infinite dimensional representations avoid that argument, because in infinite dimensions, there is no guarantee that there is a trace anyway. If you have infinite dimensional matrices, the trace could just be ill-defined, I mean infinite, right? Or ill-defined. For example, take the trace of a matrix which is diagonal and its entries are plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1, plus 1, minus 1. Infinitely many of those. The trace of that is what? It's not infinite. It's not zero. It's not zero, right? You could just, what do you get if you just add plus and minus 1 all the time, right? So for infinite dimensional matrices, the trace is generally not even defined. And so you can't just take the trace on the left and on the right and require that to be equal, because it might just be ill-defined on both sides. And that's, in fact, how it works. You know, as those of you who have been in my quantum mechanics class know, you can easily write down matrices, infinite by infinite matrices, that obey these commutation relations. And so the argument is evaded in this case. Right, and then what we get from these commutation relations is the uncertainty principle. And the uncertainty principle leads to quantum fluctuations. And in particular, the main insight that we obtain here from the consideration of the uncertainty principle is that uncertainty is a part of nature. That's revolutionary to think of, because ordinarily, uncertainty is an expression of our ignorance. Normally, if we are not certain about something, then it only means, well, we don't have enough information about it. The information is out there, but I don't have it. So it's uncertain because of that. But the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics goes way beyond that. It says, No. It's uncertain because it's fundamentally uncertain. It's undecided until you measure. So uncertainty is seen as being a feature of nature. Super important. It means that there are things that happen without a reason. They don't have a cause. They have a probability. But what event exactly is happening is unpredictable. You only can predict the statistics of it. And the fact that things can happen without a cause, without a reason, is completely non-classical. But it's absolutely fundamental in quantum mechanics. It's also very cool for cosmic inflation, for the standard model of cosmology, as we will see later in the course, because it's quantum fluctuations, things that happen without a reason, that seem to explain very well the distribution of matter in the universe, the distribution of galaxies in the universe. Fluctuations that have a quantum origin don't have a reason, right? They have statistics that we can calculate. But there is no reason. The outcome is unpredictable, not because we lack knowledge, but because nature hadn't decided it either. Now, all of this you know, of course, from quantum mechanics. But very early on, already in the 1930s, so just a few years after quantum mechanics was understood by Dirac first, non-relativistic quantum mechanics became unsatisfactory. not for conceptual reasons only, but in contradiction with experiment. So if we describe ordinary quantum mechanics of the Schrödinger and the Heisenberg kind in this way, that we say we have non-commutativity of the canonically conjugate variables, and we have the usual equations of motion. These equations always reduce the usual equations because the commutator is a representation of the Poisson bracket, and the Poisson bracket is the same in classical and quantum mechanics. That stuff, which we still teach as fourth year quantum mechanics, became unsatisfactory and in contradiction to experiment in the 1930s, almost 100 years ago already. But why? Well, mostly because quantum mechanics is not consistent with special relativity. And you might think, okay, but special relativity becomes important at really high speeds, really high velocities. And when do we ever have that in daily life? The answer is all the time. And the reason is that even hydrogen atom, which is the tamest of atoms, even the hydrogen atom has the fact that the electron in its ground state is already having a momentum that indicates a speed which is 1% of the speed of light. Which means already you have an impact of, you have relativistic corrections. And the measurements of the spectra of atoms and molecules are extremely accurate. And they used to be accurate already 100 years ago, because it's not hard to measure angles. You see, you take light and you shine it through a gas. And then at the other side, you pass it through a prism. You decompose it into its colors. And then you find that some colors are missing. Well, that's because the gas absorbed them. That's because there was a resonance. It absorbed that light, which helped the electrons to move from one energy level to another energy level, for example. And you can very accurately measure which light is missing, because it translates the color of the light, the wavelength, translates exactly into an angle. And angles can be measured very accurately, especially if you make it a large distance after the prism and so on. So that was, they could measure that stuff like 6 digits behind the comma already then, 100 years ago. Now they can measure more than 12 digits behind the comma. Spectroscopy is perhaps, I don't know if it's the most accurate experimental technology, but it's very, very accurate. So already 100 years ago, this discrepancy of was on the order of a percent, right? Because it's a percent of the speed of light, roughly speaking, it gives you modifications to, differences between prediction and experiment of, just a few digits behind the comma, you already see the differences. So the effects of special relativity were soon spectroscopically measurable and in contradiction with this kind of quantum mechanics. And I said that the hydrogen atom is the most tame one of all atoms in this regard. And the reason is that if you take a heavier atom, and every atom species is heavier than hydrogen, well, then it means that the nucleus is much more positively charged, which means that the innermost electron is much closer to the nucleus, and therefore much faster. And therefore, the chemistry there is even more relativistic. So ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics is really not good to describe, gold atoms or something. It's completely off. the accuracy is bad. So soon the quest started to find a covariant generalization of the Schrödinger equation. I didn't quite know what to do with the Heisenberg formulation. It's hard to make that one relativistic. So they started with the Schrödinger equation, and the Dirac said, let's make it covariant by moving to the Dirac equation. He didn't call it this, but that's what we now call it. And his idea was to look at the Schrödinger equation and see why it is not covariant. Well, it cannot be covariant because it has the first derivative in time, but second derivative in space. So clearly, the Schrödinger equation is not treating space and time in a Lorentz covariant way. So Dirac said, maybe what we should do is put everything on a first derivative footing. And for that, I mean, he succeeded with this. The Dirac equation is having only first derivatives in space and in time. But he had to introduce these gamma matrices for that. And then Klein and Gordon came along and said, well, or we have also second time derivatives. Then it can also be covariant. So both of these methods worked, made it covariant, but led to a whole new set of problems. And in particular, both of those, the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation, had deep problems. In particular, the energy was not bounded from below. See, if you look at the Schrödinger equation, you see that on the right-hand side, you have here a square. This is p squared. And here you have a potential, which is typically bounded from below, it's a harmonic oscillator or something like this. So that you have that the energy, this is essentially the energy operator, right? It's the Hamiltonian, that this is the Hamiltonian, so the whole thing is the energy, right? And so you find that this is bounded from below, typically, in the Schrödinger equation. Unless you have a potential that is like a Kunar potential, but it doesn't decay quite as nicely as the Kunar potential. You can also write down potentials which are worse in the sense that you have energy levels arbitrarily far down. With a Kunar potential, you don't. You know, you have a ground state at minus 13.7 or so electron volts, and then you have excited states up to the continuum where you have scattering states. But you could write down potentials such that even here you would have an unbounded Hamiltonian, unbounded from below. But unbounded from below is not physical. A theory in which you have a Hamiltonian that's unbounded from below is terrible, because that system could drop into a lower and lower and lower and lower energy state. For energy conservation reasons, it would have to emit energy, right? So this system would just keep emitting energy forever, dropping deeper and deeper into its potential and just supplying us with a free amount of energy as much as we want. Yeah, no, we are not that lucky. There are probably not such systems around. So the Schrödinger equation typically has Hamiltonians only that are bounded from below. Anyways, the potential that we know have this property. But with the Dirac equation, good luck with that, because it has only first derivative here. How is that ever going to be bounded from below? And it's not, right? What you get is, you know, for every particle, an antiparticle. In principle, that has negative energy. And it took some ingenuity, first by Dirac and then others, to try to figure something out to make it work. But in principle, negative energies. The Klein-Gordon equation, too. And the Klein-Gordon equation has also has as many positive as negative energies, and it's unbounded above, also unbounded below, simply because on the left-hand side you have the square of this derivative. And what that means is that the energy being the square of what's on the left-hand side, as the square root of it, you get a positive and a negative square root. So again, not stable. In other words, the Dirac equation, the Klein-Gordon equation are energetically not stable. If you replace the Schrödinger equation by the Dirac equation or the Klein-Gordon equation and treat it like a Schrödinger equation, then that theory is sick. It just is energetically not bounded from below in general and therefore cannot be stable. Of course, the solution is to have the Dirac equation, the Klein-Gordon equation, but not to treat it like the Schrödinger equation, but instead to do quantum field theory, right? But they didn't know that at that time. At that time, they just thought, okay, we know how to handle the Schrödinger equation, but it's not covariant. Let's just fix it by making it covariant. But then by making it covariant, they lost the ability to keep the energy bounded from below. Yes?
It's not obvious to me. What is the relation between being a first-order derivative and being unbounded?
Well, you see, if on the right hand, if on the right hand side, the Schrödinger equation has here a p squared, momentum squared, it's positive. But if you just have the momentum, well, you have it positive and you have it negative, right? It's just that you either have a parabola or you just have a straight line. It's really as simple as that. Yep.
So the argument about the boundedness is that this thing would keep decaying into like lower energy states. But
yeah,
don't you need to couple with another system?
Yeah, that's right.
So like if you had a spectrum that was like getting arbitrarily large gaps in, couldn't it still be stable?
Yeah, no, that's right. That's a very good point. And that's one of the reasons why we need quantum field theory. Let me translate, or let me paraphrase what you just said. You fold on the hydrogen atom, right, within quantum mechanics. And if you think about it, something super important was missing. When you study quantum mechanics, the quantum mechanics of the hydrogen atom, you calculate the energy levels of the electron. And you find that they have, there's a discrete spectrum there, and these are the eigenvalues correspond to the eigenvectors, so the Hamiltonian. And in particular, you could arrange, for example, to have your electron in the seventh excited state. And since it is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, it's forever going to be in that state, because the eigenstate of a Hamiltonian always evolves into the same eigenstate, right? That's the point. Eigenstates of the Hamiltonian do not evolve in time. They acquire only a phase in front of the state vector, but the state vector itself stays the same. But remember that that's not how nature behaves at all. If you take an electron around a proton and put it in the seventh excited state, well then, yes, it's in the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but we know what will happen is that it will decay pretty quickly into maybe other states and then eventually the ground state while emitting photons. And that is not in the textbooks for quantum mechanics. But in this course, we will see how to calculate that. Right? So Evan is right. In principle, if you had an isolated electron around a proton that doesn't couple to anything else, then if it was in the seventh excited state, it would never decay. And there could be infinitely many lower energy states. It would never reach them. It would just stay in the eigenstate in which it is. It would never decay. However, in nature, we know that everything is coupled to everything else. And therefore, actually, what we have to consider is not the hydrogen atom in isolation. We have to consider the hydrogen atom coupled to other systems. If, for example, what we want to calculate is the decay of a hydrogen atom. So a hydrogen atom is in excited state, and then it emits a photon, the electron goes into a lower energy state. Or the opposite process. A photon comes along, and it excites the electron around a proton into a higher state. How do we calculate that? Well, the way we can calculate that is that we consider not only the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom, no, we also consider, we add to it the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field. And we add to it the Hamiltonian that describes the interaction between the two. So we have a total Hamiltonian, which consists of the Hamiltonian of just the electron around the proton, the Hamiltonian of just the electromagnetic field, and the so-called interaction Hamiltonian that describes how the two interact. And then we see that just because an electron is in the seventh excited state of the Hamiltonian of the atom doesn't mean that it's in an eigenstate of the total system. It's not, right? It's not in an eigenstate of the total system where we have the sum of these three Hamiltonians. And that's why that seventh eigenstate actually evolves in time into something that's no longer the seventh eigenstate, that has an overlap with other states. And actually what it will evolve into is a state where a photon has been emitted and the electron goes into the ground state. We will see exactly how that happens. I mean, we will do that. But for that, we will have to first find out how do we quantize. How do we do the quantum theory of the electromagnetic field or any other field? And then we can couple that to, for example, an atom or a molecule. And then we can do what we just said. We just add up the Hamiltonians of the individual systems, and we can calculate absorption and emission processes. In this course, we will do this, but not with a focus on emission and absorption. Yeah, emission and absorption is like emotion if you mix them. Anyway, so we will focus on emission and absorption, but also the same physics of emission and absorption is behind the Hawking effect, Hawking radiation, and it's also behind the formation of structure in the universe, as we will see. I mean, this is all too fast now, but we will do this slowly and carefully in this course. So far, I was explaining that because relativity is, special relativity is important in atomic and molecular physics, quantum mechanics had to be improved and had to be made relativistic. So they took the Schrödinger equation and turned it into the Dirac equation and Klein-Gordon equation, but tried to treat it just the same way as the Schrödinger equation. And that doesn't quite work out because the energy is no longer bounded from below. Also, the unitarity of the time evolution was no longer guaranteed or transparent. And also, it remained unclear how one could describe a new phenomenon that had, up to date, never been observed before, which is that one kind of matter can become another kind of matter. For example, nuclear decay. But they also found, for example, that an electron and a positron might crash into each other, annihilate, and you get two photons out of it. Or photons could turn into electrons. And you could generally have protons go into neutrons and all sorts of changes in the nature of particles could be created. So particles could be created and annihilated. And the quantum mechanics of Schrödinger and of Heisenberg has no means of describing the creation or annihilation of particles. So for example, in the Schrödinger equation, remember that what we have is that the Schrödinger quantum mechanics approach, we have that the probability that a particle is found between a location, let's say from A to B, right? This would be the probability that we find the particle in the interval A to B, right? And if we integrate all of that up, so we ask, what's the probability that we find the particle anywhere? And this is one dimensional now, but it works the same way in any number of dimensions. Then that is one. So on one hand, you can interpret this as saying the probability that we find the particle somewhere is one. But another way to see this is to say that the number of particles that we have is one. Right? So the normalization of the wave function is the statement that we are dealing with exactly one particle. And the unitarity of the time evolution then expresses that the number of particles doesn't change. Now, so it remained unclear how, from the perspective of the Heisenberg and Schrödinger quantum mechanics, how one could describe the actual annihilation or creation of particles. So unitarity, energy unboundedness, which means stability of the physics, and the description of particle creation and annihilation were big challenges. A new idea was needed. And within just a few years, in the 1930s, they came up with a really great idea. It was a great idea, but probably wrong, but with the correct end result. So the idea goes back probably to Heisenberg. And Heisenberg said this. He said, I need to shift this up. What? Oh, this thing is frozen. Ay, ay, ay. See, on my screen, I can see things here, but all right, I have to log into it again. What was it again? 10, 30, 21, 9, 1. Okay, so Heisenberg's idea was the idea of second quantization. The first quantization was to go from classical mechanics to quantum mechanics, and the idea of second quantization was to do that again, to take a quantum mechanical theory and quantize it again. In fact, people then considered also third quantization and zeroth quantization. I'll tell you a little bit about it. But first of all, what was the idea of second quantization? Second quantization is nowadays synonymous with quantum field theory. If people say, oh, let's do the second quantization, what they mean is, let's do it quantum field theoretically. So the idea was this. Heisenberg said, in quantum mechanics, so the way that Heisenberg and Schrödinger did it, everything is subject to quantum fluctuations. Everything has an uncertainty principle, except for the wave function itself. Psi of x and t doesn't seem to be fluctuating. It seems to behave classically. Namely, if you know psi of x and t, the wave function, at the initial time, then using a Schrödinger equation, you can calculate exactly what psi of x and t is at the later time. There is no fluctuation in this. It's completely deterministic. It's like a sound wave propagating. So the wave function itself, Heisenberg complained, the wave function itself is evolving deterministically, whereas x and p are fluctuating and so on, and non-commuting and having uncertainty principles. The wave function itself, number-valued, deterministically following a differential equation, as if it was the old days of classical mechanics. So the idea of Heisenberg then was to say, let's try to quantize yet again. Let's quantize that wave function. Quantize psi. Make it operator valued. Make it non-commutative as well. So Heisenberg's program was to say, just like the momentum is the derivative, the time derivative of the position, he said, well, if the wave function is supposed to be a quantum variable itself, then it should have a canonically conjugate, which is its time derivative. You see, x is a quantum variable, a quantum observable, and its time derivative is the momentum in suitable units in which the mass is 1. Heisenberg wasn't concerned with little things like prefactors. So just like the momentum is essentially the time derivative of this canonical variable, he said, well, okay, so let's put a hat on the psi of x and t, and then consider its time derivative and call this the canonically conjugate momentum to psi. Now, regarding the positions, you have 3 of those. And therefore, you have 3 canonically conjugate momenta. How about the psi? Well, you see, psi, there is a psi for every x. For every position, there is an amplitude psi. And that means that we don't just have 3 of these variables here, like in quantum mechanics. No, for the psi of x, we have, for at every location, we have one of those psi hats. And therefore, we have uncountably many quantum variables psi hat. And their canonically conjugate pi hat. And then just like previously, Heisenberg had said, OK, x hat and p hat commutator should be this. He then said, well, maybe the psi hat and the pi hat, where pi hat is just the time derivative of the psi hat, maybe their commutator should be ih bar times Dirac delta now, because this is continuous variables. Now, that looks like an unlikely program to succeed, but it worked. This worked out. So the idea was here that if you do this, then clearly the psi and the pi, being non-commutative, will have to be operator valued. And there's going to be uncertainties and so on. And it actually worked out. So the consequences were these. First of all, mathematically speaking, and then we do the physics. So first, mathematically speaking, doing this so-called second quantization, where you put non-commutativity on the wave function itself, The mathematical consequences are quite predictable. The psi hat and the pi hat can no longer be number valued, because if they were number valued, then they would commute, right? So the original psi of x and t and pi of x and t were complex number valued. But now they cannot be, because they're non-commutative. So what we have is that at every point in time, at every location in space, we have that psi hat is an operator, some sort of infinite by infinite matrix or other operator on some Hilbert space. And following the original discovery of Dirac, that quantization means keep the equations of motion, make things non-commutative. Heisenberg said, let's do the same thing again. Okay, so we made the psi and the pi non-commutative, but we keep the equations of motion. So he said, keep the Dirac equation. Keep the Klein-Gordon equation. They're good. They are relativistic. But make their psi and pi non-commutative. And then when they're non-commutative, they will be operator valued and all of that. So things will be much more complicated, but maybe they will work out. And it turns out, yes, it will then work out. Because then when you do that, suddenly you find, oh, the energy is bounded from below. And you find that the unitarity is fine. And you find that you can also describe the creation and annihilation of particles in this way. Namely, let's consider now the physical consequences of quantizing for the second time. So if you have non-commutativity of the wave function and it's canonically conjugate, then you must also have an uncertainty principle. And you have then a Dirac delta here, which means that the psi and the pi are fluctuating. Of course, we will later in the course have to consider what exactly that means, because unlike the Kronecker delta of ordinary quantum mechanics, which is 0 or 1, this thing is 0 or undefined, 0 or infinite, if you like. So that's much more non-trivial here. And what it also means is that the fluctuations of the psi and the pi are much more violent, because it's infinite. The h bar is amplified by an infinite factor here. And as you will later see, that has consequences. What it actually means, and let me just anticipate already how that works. What it means is that if you look at the quantum fluctuations of the field and the canonically conjugate field, what you find is that the smaller the distances are at which you look, the more violent are the fluctuations. You see, what you have to do is, in order to actually calculate an uncertainty principle like this, is that you have to smear this psi over. So you smear it over a Gaussian or something like that, some smearing function. And then you get a commutator for these smeared psis and pis. And then you don't get the Dirac delta anymore. You get some smeared function there. And then you get the smeared uncertainty principle. And the steeper the smearing function is, the more localized it is, the larger is this thing on the right-hand side. Just because any approximation to the Dirac delta, the better the approximation gets, the spikier the approximation is going to be. And what that means is that quantum fluctuations of fields are small at large scales. We don't usually see them. But if you probe them at small scales, they become large, and dramatically large, in fact, which has a lot of consequences for quantum field theory in practice. But the bottom line for now is that because we have non-commutativity, we have uncertainty principles, and therefore the wave function, or actually we should call it in this case a field, the field is now subject to quantum fluctuations and uncertainties. So we shouldn't expect this to hold anymore. Now, that was saying that the probability for finding the particle somewhere is 1. Well, you might have a particle and later no longer have it. Or you put somewhere 3 particles, and next time you check, you find 7. Or maybe you take 2 particles, and then 5 particles come out. All of this is possible in accelerator experiments, but also with black holes and in cosmology and so on. Particle numbers are not necessarily conserved, and particles can get created and destroyed. And all of that is happening under the mantle of the uncertainty principle, where stuff is fluctuating anyway. So new phenomena are predicted by the second quantization. In particular, regarding particles, we now predict that there's particle creation and annihilation, simply because the wave function itself fluctuates. You can't expect that the normalization is still maintained. We also expect that there might be antiparticles now. That's not so easy to see why that is. Dirac was ingeniously anticipating that, but essentially what's going on is this. As we discussed earlier, if you naively just take the Schrödinger equation and turn it into the Klein-Gordon or the Dirac equation without second quantization, just treating it as if you treated the Schrödinger equation, then you run into problems with the energy that is no longer unbounded from below. But quantum field theory, that is to say the second quantized theory, takes care of that in that it turns those negative energy states into positive energy states for antiparticles. So that's how second quantization saves that. That's how second quantization makes the Hamiltonians bounded from below. In fact, there is a YouTube video and a book with the lecture notes, a YouTube video of Feynman addressing that exact point. In 1986 or 1985, he gave the Dirac Memorial Lecture in Cambridge. And that appeared as a book, and recently it also appeared, or maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it appeared, the video recording appeared on YouTube. And you can see Feynman explaining firsthand, so you get it out from the horse's mouth, so to speak, right? Explain exactly why relativity necessitates the existence of antiparticles. Right? We had to do all of this because of relativity. And then the solution was second quantization, and then we see that what used to be a problem, the negative energy states that are unbounded, that turns into something positive, namely the prediction of antiparticles, which of course were then found, and so it's all good, these particles really exist, and nature is stable. So the physics is twofold. On one hand, regarding particles, now that we have the uncertainty principle, we have that the fields are fluctuating because of the uncertainty principle, so we expect that particles could be created, annihilated, that particle number may not even be, the number of particles may not even be fixed, or it might be quantum uncertain. But what does it mean regarding fields, the field amplitudes themselves? Well, what it means is that it means that for fields, something happens that we have seen before also in quantum mechanics, which is fluctuations around the lowest energy state. Take, for example, a harmonic oscillator. A harmonic oscillator has a lowest energy state, which is down here. But the quantum harmonic oscillator has an elevated amount of energy. And the reason is this. In a quantum harmonic oscillator, the ground state is a state which is a Gaussian. Right? So this is psi of x, and this is v of x for the harmonic oscillator. And that Gaussian is a compromise, right? In principle, the particle would want to be at the lowest energy state and sit there. But then delta x would be very small, which by the uncertainty principle makes delta p large. But if it has large delta p, then it can shoot up the potential. So the compromise is that the lowest energy state is actually a state of this Gaussian type. So the particle is, with the highest probability, at the bottom of the potential, but it has finite probability to be further out, where the potential is elevated. And therefore, actually, the energy expectation value is h bar omega half in the ground state, right? And the reason is that even though the particle is most likely to be found at the lowest energy state, in practice, you will always find it to the left or to the right. This is the probability distribution, right? I mean, what are the chances that it will be exactly at that point? So in practice, if you measure where the particle is in a harmonic oscillator, in a ground state, this is the probability distribution where it is. And you can translate that, you can calculate from that what the probability is that it is at that energy or this energy or that energy and so on. And then the expectation value of all of that is exactly h bar omega half. Now, quantum fields, such as the electromagnetic field, or a Klein-Gordon field, or a Dirac field, they are all described by second-order Hamiltonians, which makes them first-order differential equations. I mean, second-order, if you think of, let's say, the Schrödinger equation, the Klein-Gordon equation or the Maxwell equation. For fermions, it's a little different. The Dirac equation is first-order. So if you look at the Klein-Gordon equation or the Maxwell equation, they're second-order equations, which means the solutions are sine and cosine, which tells you that by a suitable change of coordinates, and we will see that, or variables, we will see that later in the course, you can decompose the problem of solving the Maxwell equations or the problem of solving the Klein-Gordon equations into a bunch of harmonic oscillators. Because the harmonic oscillators have sine and cosines as their solutions, and so do the Maxwell equations. And that's just to say that the Maxwell equations, as do the Klein-Gordon equations, they decompose into just an infinite set of ordinary harmonic oscillators. And these harmonic oscillators, in second quantization, are quantum harmonic oscillators. And as a consequence, what happens is that if you look at this wave function of the field, or, you know, just this could be the electromagnetic field or a Klein-Gordon field. If you look at the lowest energy state, that would be analogous to the harmonic oscillator lowest energy state, the ground state. So the vacuum state, then the expectation value of the field would be zero. Right? So in the vacuum, let's say you take a box and you make it completely tight so that no light can go in, and you cool it down so that there's also no heat radiation, then in that box, let's say you measure the electric field, the expectation value is zero. I mean, why would it have an electric field in one or another direction, right? The expectation value is zero. But when you actually measure it, the electric field, you will generally not find it zero. Just like the harmonic oscillator, the quantum harmonic oscillator. In the ground state, it has this probability distribution for its x value, right? For a quantum field, the electric field strength, the most likely finding for the field strength is zero. But in practice, it's always going to be positive or negative. And the same for the Klein-Gordon field. So for the Klein-Gordon field, for example, if you plot a typical measurement outcome of the Klein-Gordon field amplitude over the x and y coordinate, it looks like this. And that's a consequence of the uncertainty principle. It's a consequence of the commutation relations. And one of the things that I ask you to do in the project then is to learn how to calculate that and to produce these pictures. And then we will see how these pictures change when the space-time is no longer Minkowski space, but it's expanding, and how we can calculate that for cosmology. And maybe you also want to calculate it for Hawking radiation. All right, so even the vacuum isn't empty, because in the vacuum, you have fluctuations of the field, you have fluctuations of particles. Just like the quantum harmonic oscillator in its ground state is still fluctuating, the quantum harmonic oscillators that make up the electromagnetic field, Klein-Gordon field, and other fields are also fluctuating. So second quantization works like this. Now, second quantization has been very successful. It's now called quantum field theory, or second quantization. And there are two main application areas of second quantization. One application area is to the study of the interactions between particles. So you study, for example, how do electrons interact with quarks and with W bosons and neutrinos. Now, if you apply second quantization in this way, then you need to consider the Dirac fields of electrons, of muons and tauons, and the Dirac fields of quarks, and then you need to consider the electromagnetic fields of the of photons, and then the W and Z bosons, and so on. So you have interacting quantum field theories. You have lots of Hamiltonians of lots of different field species, and you have Hamiltonians of how they interact with each other. And what you obtain is the standard model of particle physics. Huge volumes of books have been written about this. It's very successful. It describes whatever we can do in the experiments. So what at CERN is experimented is the collision of particles, and therefore the interaction of the various particle species. And all of that is described by quantum field theory. And it's the quantum field, it's quantum field theory or second quantization applied to particle physics, the standard model of particle physics. You use that to describe the electromagnetic interaction, the weak and the strong interaction. And I'm mentioning now what the issues are that are being considered when you study second quantization applied to the interaction between fields. It's not what we will do in this course, but I just want for completeness to explain to you that quantum field theory or second quantization has two application areas: to particle physics, where these issues come up, and the second is cosmology, Hawking radiation, and Andrew effect, and so on. So the part that we are not going to do still deserves mention, namely considering specifically the electromagnetic weak and strong forces, which are the three fundamental forces other than gravity. And then you find phenomena such as screening and anti-screening and renormalization, which is essentially saying that if you study the interaction between particles, you get weird phenomena. For example, if you study the interaction of an electron with another electron, you might think all that can happen is that they might, you know, exchange a photon. Well, that would be the simplest they can do. But an electron can also emit a photon, which along the way to the other electron, this photon might split up into an electron-positron pair, which then re-annihilates and then creates a photon again, which interacts with the electron. But you can also have that this electron-positron pair is emitting photons again, with which they interact, and so on. And what that means is that an electron never sees another electron unimpeded. There's always this cloud of other stuff happening in between. And that is super hard to calculate. The process for calculating this is called renormalization. But it needs to be done. And when it is done, then you can predict the outcome of experiments to many digits behind a comma. This is really the way to go. Another thing that very interesting to study in this case is the origin of mass in particles. Where does the electron get its mass from? Where does the muon get its mass from? And there's the so-called Higgs effect that describes how these particles get their mass. It shouldn't be too much hype, though, because not all mass of particles has its origin in the Higgs effect. For example, in a proton, most of the mass of the proton is not because of the Higgs effect. It's true that the quarks that are in there have a mass because of the Higgs effect, but the quarks also have mass because they are fast. See, they are confined in the proton, so the delta x is small, so the delta p is large, so these quarks are very fast, so they have kinetic energy. And every energy gravitates, every energy contributes to the mass. So it's not the case that all particle masses have their origin in the Higgs effect. There is also kinetic energy. Anyway, and then there is also other super exciting phenomena that I very much recommend you look into, for example, the phenomenon of anomalies. Super cool stuff. Think of a classical theory that has symmetries. Remember, if you have a symmetry, then you have a Noether's theorem, you get a conservation law, and so on. Now, it turns out that when you have a Hamiltonian that has some symmetries in the classical case, quantum mechanically, it could be that the symmetry is destroyed by the quantization. And the phenomenon of symmetries destroyed by quantization is called an anomaly. So these are things that we are not going to cover in this course, but I just wanted to mention that this exists and is interesting. Right, so what we are going to do, though, is apply second quantization to the standard model of cosmology. So as what we are going to do is this. We're going to do quantum field theory, or second quantization, and combine it with mostly classical general relativity, but not entirely. Because it turns out that in the standard model of cosmology, there are circumstances where we actually have to quantize general relativity too. Admittedly, it's only perturbative. So that means we're not quantizing the full general relativity, but we are saying that we are considering a classical solution and then quantum fluctuations around that. Now, in order to do that, in order to do the standard model of cosmology, we have to study the interplay of general relativity with quantum field theory. And what that means is that we will have to study how quantum field theory, or second quantization, is impacted by accelerations, because via the equivalence principle, accelerations are locally indistinguishable from curvature or gravity. Right? So we will need to study how quantum field theory is affected by accelerations, how it's affected by curvature, and how it is affected by horizons. And then we can concretely see, studying these things, accelerations for example, we see the Unruh effect. And the Unruh effect is important because the Unruh effect, which is the Unruh effect, is the phenomenon that when a system is accelerated, then that system will behave as if it was exposed to a heat bath. And it turns out that this phenomenon is very closely related. It's not the same, but very closely related via the equivalence principle to Hawking radiation. See, if you are close to a black hole, and you're suspended, so to speak. Let's say you have a friend who is parked with a spaceship far away from the black hole, and that friend anchors a rope on which you're tied. So you're dangling over the black hole, so to speak, so that you're not falling into it. Then when you're dangling over the black hole, it feels to you as if you were accelerated. You cannot tell whether you're being accelerated or whether you're just dangling from a black hole. It feels the same, right? If a rope is accelerating you, or a rope just holding you in place over a black hole, feels the same, right? But in any case, if you were dangling over a black hole, you would be exposed to the black hole radiation, to the Hawking radiation. And if, on the other hand, there is no black hole, but the rope is pulling you very fast, then you will also feel as if you were exposed to radiation, but in this case, it's the Unruh radiations, the Unruh effect. And one of the key insights that we will gain by studying the Unruh effect is that we will find out what is a particle. It goes really to the heart of the particle-wave duality. And then we will study the Hawking effect. And the Hawking effect is, of course, important for various reasons. But what I think is the most important reason for why the Hawking effect is interesting is this. The Hawking effect is, of course, that if you throw something into a black hole, its energy will eventually come out again in the form of Hawking radiation. So you could take a book and throw it into a black hole, and the energy of the book will come out in the Hawking radiation. The big question is whether the information that was in the book also comes out. Of course, not easily, but in principle. The question is it a unitary time evolution, or is it not? If it is not a unitary time evolution, then it means that nature has a means to destroy information. It would mean that the time evolution is not unitary. And that would mean that, yeah, information can be erased, namely through a black hole. Nobody's quite sure. At the moment, the prevailing opinion in the community is that nature probably cannot destroy information, and the information that was thrown into a black hole will come out in the form of Hawking radiation, but it's not conclusively settled. But what we will do is, of course, derive the Hawking effect, and then you can take it from there and prove it one way or the other. And then we do cosmic inflation, which answers the question, or tries to answer the question, where did it all come from? So why is it that stuff is distributed the way in the universe that it is? Where does the structure come from? And the evidence is, the best theory that we have is cosmic inflation. And it says, as we discussed at the beginning of the class today, that the distribution of matter in the universe traces quantum fluctuations that occurred very early on. And just roughly, to give you a quick rough idea of what cosmic inflation is, so the currently prevailing theory of cosmology, cosmic inflation assumes that there is a scalar field in nature, which is of cosmological significance. This scalar field is called the inflaton field, and we have no independent confirmation of that inflaton field. Nobody has seen it in an accelerator. But the inflaton field is expected to have a large mass, and therefore maybe that's not surprising. However, if you look into the standard model of particle physics, you find there is a scalar field, and just one. It's the Higgs field. And it could be that the Higgs field is that inflaton field. But that's currently under debate. But be that as it may, what cosmic inflation says is this. If in nature there is a scalar field, which has the potential, as the Higgs field has, then because of the non-commutativity of the observables, that is to say, because of the uncertainty principle for the field, we have that the potential of the field is fluctuating. Right? The field is fluctuating, and therefore the potential is fluctuating, just like the harmonic oscillator. It's just that here's an entire field, and a field is made out of infinitely many harmonic oscillators. So because of quantum fluctuations, we have that the potential of the scalar field fluctuates up and down. And in principle, it's always possible that this potential fluctuates enormously. It could be that in some small patch, the amplitude might fluctuate just without any reason, just randomly, to a really large value. And we're talking here Planck distances in volume and an amplitude that reaches almost the Planckian energy. It's unlikely, but there's a lot of universe to go around, and it just needs to happen at some point. So if at some point that happens, that the potential energy happens to fluctuate to be really large in some small region, then the nonlinearity of the Einstein equations necessarily implies that at that point where that happened, a new universe gets spawned. And that's because a high potential of a scalar field acts like a cosmological constant. A scalar energy always acts as a negative pressure. That's just built into the Einstein equations. You don't need any further assumptions for this. It's automatic. If a scalar potential is large, then it creates a negative pressure. And if that pressure is large enough, then it means that locally, you just have bulging out a whole new universe. And you shouldn't imagine this to push aside what was near to it. It creates its own space, its own volume. And so what you can have is that in an existing universe, new universes could be spawned all the time. And those could spawn new universes. So what was discovered is that if you just take the Klein-Gordon theory of a scalar field and combine it with general relativity, then you find that the universe is not stable. It's not stable because that can happen at any time. It's super unlikely, but if you travel far enough, you might just find somewhere fluctuations that's big enough for that. There could also be other reasons for why that might be triggered, but it could even just happen on its own. Now, what kind of universe do we get when that happens? So what kind of daughter universe is spawned? Well, because it's going to blow up exponentially fast, again, it's general relativity, comes up automatically. Because it's going to be exponentially fast, the universe, the daughter universe that you get, is canonically almost flat. It's going to be huge and almost flat, spatially almost flat. But then you have quantum fluctuations, again, unavoidably. Quantum fluctuations of that field, which give it inhomogeneities. And if you calculate through that, you find a universe, a daughter universe, that looks pretty much like ours. It's very weird, but that's how this works out. So then, if we take one of those daughter universes, the picture that's often shown is this, that we have these quantum fluctuations then of the inflaton field in this newly spawned daughter universe, and then these quantum fluctuations seed the condensation of the energy that was there initially into clouds of hydrogen that then form galaxies and stars, and then over time we have that these collapse, you get galaxies, you get stars, you get clusters of them, and eventually you get the sky as you see it. And the amazing thing is that while this is all spanning enormous orders of magnitude and is super complicated, it's the winning theory compared to experiment. In the 1980s and 90s, there were several theories that tried to predict what the statistics is of the distribution of galaxies in the sky, because it was clear that it will be measured, but it wasn't measured yet. The cosmic microwave background had been detected already early, like 60 years ago, but not with any accuracy. But it was clear that it would be measured with accuracy. And so the pressure was on to make predictions for what would be measured, what is the distribution of structure in the cosmic microwave background, which is a snapshot from these early times there, and then also from the distribution of galaxies. And many theories were proposed there, and this one is the one that won. I mean, I'm not telling you about all the others, but there were others, and this one won. So it's not something that we are post-dicting here. It was actually predicted. Now, of course, it's a back and forth between theory and experiment, and you can say, oh yeah, you can always introduce more parameters to fix something better, but we should not forget that this was predicted, actually, before it was measured, which is pretty cool. Okay, so this is what this course is all about. You have a question?
Just a small question. Is this process you're describing of spawning daughter universes, can we continuously describe it, or is there like jumps?
Nobody knows. You see, the standard model of cosmology doesn't include the spawning of daughter universes. We don't know how to describe that. For that, you would need quantum gravity. What we can do is this. We can say, assuming that we have an elevated potential, and we make some approximations there so that we can solve the equations. Assuming you have an elevated potential, then we have this exponential runaway solution where we have a flat space, and then it's flattened out because of the dramatically fast expansion. And then quantum fluctuations imprint structure on that. That process we can calculate. But the actual process of how daughter universes get spawned, yeah, there's papers written about it, but I don't think that's ready to be said this is the standard model. We don't, honestly, we don't really know. It looks like it's the most likely thing, because you make the least assumptions with this, and people are looking for evidence of this spawning. But there's also speculation that what's really going on is that in this spawning process, the rest of the laws of nature might be reset. It could be that, for example, one of these daughter universes doesn't have electrons and protons as we know it. You know, the constants of nature might be readjusted in that spawning process because it's so violent, it's so energetic, because it happens at such small scales, such high energies, that it could be that maybe the electron charge is changed. Could be that the mass of some quarks is different, and that would change everything. And it could be that in this way we have universes, spawning universes, and so on. And most of them might be short-lived and not livable. And we find ourselves in one of those daughter universes in which we have livable circumstances. I mean, for example, if the gravitational constant was just a little bit different, then either the stars would be too dim and never explode. I mean, would take much longer to explode and therefore much longer to do a supernova, or they wouldn't even go supernova, but we need supernovas to create heavy elements. Or if the gravitational constant was changing in the other direction, then the stars would burn too brightly and they would just blow too quickly, and you don't have enough time for evolution to take hold. Like, our sun is like 5 billion years old, the Earth is 4.7 billion years or whatever old, and this is as long as evolution took to produce us. But if stars were only living 50 million years, then planets probably have no chance to create life. So there's a lot of speculation there about the entropic principle, meaning that maybe the laws of nature are what they are, because if they weren't, we couldn't exist. And that, of course, presumes that nature is actually trying out all sorts of different laws of nature. Not necessarily in our universe, but in, you know, other daughter universes and so on. But then it's all conceptually really on shaky ground. For example, imagine that you have a universe spawning a daughter universe. You know, where you basically have one of these large fluctuations of the potential, and then it mushrooms out, this daughter universe. And it could even be that it sort of decouples, right? It's just like, you take a big water drop and turn it into two droplets that are no longer connected. But if the two sub-universes now are no longer connected, then it's not the case that one is in the future or the past of the other. They're just not connected. Right? There is no path in space, no path in time. They cannot be ordered. There is no external time that would order things. Right? And so you would even lose the ability to say one is the daughter of the other. Maybe you could, tracking causality somehow, but you can't say it on the grounds of there being a time-like curve that you could travel there. All very speculative. But in this course, we want to keep it to the basic things that we know for sure, where we have predictions that are matched with high accuracy in the observations. And that's already exciting enough. I think it's just super exciting to know that the statistics of the distribution of matter in the universe, and that includes essentially us too, that statistics matches the statistics that was predicted before it was measured from the statistics of quantum fluctuations of fields. That's amazing stuff. All right, so that's as far as we got today.